We're here to talk about curing affluenza. Richard Jenness, as you know, is the chief economist at the Australia Institute, has produced a sequel to another famous Australia Institute book, Affluenza. And it's a book that takes some of its themes from Affluenza, but I think is much bigger and more important book than the first. It's a book of our times and for our times. It's a how-to book. It's a book about economics and politics. And it's a book about how to change both. It's a book that's had rave reviews. It's a book that has received an enormous amount of media and political attention and is set to do so both here and overseas. So it's a great treat to be able to discuss it with you and, of course, with Richard. So we're going to open up with me throwing a couple of questions at Richard, not in not too difficult a fashion, but then open it up to you. I'll have the first go, but please have a think of what you'd like to ask. If you've read the book, any questions about it, or if you haven't read the book and you think it might connect to some aspects of the political debate or policy discussion, have a think and we'll get into that soon enough. But Richard, first of all, congratulations.
Thanks, Ben.
On a terrific book, as I said, that's been hugely well-received. And I might start at the beginning in a sense, and the thing that most media attention has focused on, which I think is the kernel of what the book is about, and as you've told me before, a kind of in some ways a breathtakingly simple concept, but in another way is a very revolutionary one that I don't think many people have thought about much, and that is the fundamental difference between consumerism and materialism and why one is good and why one is bad.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks so much for putting on tonight, everybody, and for coming along. I've done lots of launches, but it's nice to do one in the hometown. As Ben said, I didn't say it was revolutionary. I thought it might have been too simple. But the real germ of the idea for the book was that consumerism and materialism are actually polar opposites, the way I define them at least. So for me, consumerism is the... Whoops. A fan of consumerism, I think, trying to break my flow. So for me, consumerism is the love... Yeah, I think that's making noise. The microphone's talking to us. So for me, consumerism is the love of buying things, the act of the purchase, the thrill of getting something new. And we've all experienced it. There's no doubt about that. It's an entirely human reaction. I mean, people like getting presents. We've invented shops to make us feel like we're getting presents. It's no accident. It comes cheerily wrapped and handed to you. So for me, consumerism is the love of buying stuff, but materialism is the love of the stuff itself, the actual thing, the actual object. Now, if you really loved an object, if you loved a thing, then the idea of disposing of it would cause you pain, not joy. So what I'm saying in the book is that we actually need to love our stuff. We need to care for it, we need to maintain it, we need to repair it, and when we're finished with it, we need to take some steps towards finding it a new home. So if we all love our stuff, if we look after it, if we protect it, if we maintain it, if we repair it, then we'll be able to tread far more lightly on the earth than if we all aspire to going recreational shopping and buying new stuff. So rather than feeling bad that you love your bike or love your car or love whatever the thing you love is, I actually think that's great. Whatever you love, hang on to it. Don't be ashamed of that. That kind of materialism is, I think, the only way that 7 billion people can live on the world and not ruin it.
Let's take up a bit of a theme that you mentioned there, and I'll come back to a bit of a bigger picture discussion of the book. Perhaps I wanted to get straight into it. You write towards the end of the book, on the other hand, curing affluenza does not require enormous personal or economic sacrifice. Can you explain that? Because I guess most people, when they hear about affluenza in the beginning, they think, well, that's something that is bad, and to solve the planet's or society's ills, or this society's ills, I'll have to have less, and it's going to have to be pretty tough for us to cure all the problems. What do you mean when you say that it doesn't require enormous personal sacrifice?
Yeah, it doesn't require enormous sacrifice. For many years, like for 20 years, I was vegetarian. I'm not anymore, but for 20 years, I was vegetarian. And when I would go to a restaurant or go to some sort of buffet, you know, I speak a lot, so I see a lot of buffets, I saw a lot of meat kind of served up that I never saw as food. I never thought, oh, look at that thing that I don't eat drawing me in. I just saw things that weren't food for me. I never felt when I was vegetarian that I was sacrificing anything. I just didn't see that as something that I wanted. So we've kind of told ourselves that if we want to tread more lightly on the earth, we'll have to buy far less stuff that we don't need, that we chuck out without ever using. We'll have to go without that exercise bike that we never rode. We'll have to go without all that crap. Well, go without what? So, yeah, I mean, yes, if you define happiness as going to the shops to buy things you don't need, leaving them in the spare room for a while and then chucking them out, if that's what happiness is for you, then I guess I am saying there'd be sacrifice. But if you understand that we buy material objects, stuff, material things, but we buy them for symbolic reasons. We buy them to show ourselves or our friends or someone that we've got the latest one. Once we realise that that's a pretty strange thing to do, then we don't have to have huge sacrifice to go and spend our time and money differently. You know, instead of buying some crap you don't need, go and get a massage. Instead of buying a lot of food that you throw out without eating, learn to sing or dance or get your kid a maths tutor. There's plenty of things we can do differently. The idea that we're really sacrificing by stopping buying stuff we don't use is odd.
As I said, I thought I'd come back to the big picture, get into some detail. Why did you write the book?
why did I write the book? Because, oh, you set me up. Because so many things about our public debate just don't make sense. The idea that a country can get rich by importing stuff and then burying it in the ground. Like, just say that out loud a few times in the next couple of days. And just see what people's reaction is. But we know that having a strong retail sector is good for the economy. And we know that having a strong retail sector creates jobs. So we know in the lead up to Christmas, when we're buying crap that we know people will bury in the ground soon, we're helping make the economy strong. I mean, what on earth does that even mean? Similarly, like we've been told, or we're told there's been a debate going on for decades about, is economic growth good or bad? Well, I'm an economist and I just sort of think, well, that's a strange question to ask. I think that growth of the renewable energy sector is good, and I think growth of the coal mining sector is bad. I don't have a strong view on the net effect. And I want the things that I want more of to grow, and I want the things that I want less of to shrink. Yet we've kind of jumped over that important democratic debate. What do you want more of? What do you want less of? And into a debate about, do we want more or less? So I think all of that is really kind of caught up in the idea that the more stuff we buy, the better off we are. But the more thing gets in the way of the which things. And if we as a society were spending a lot more money on preventative health and a lot better, more money looking after people in aged care homes and a lot more money looking after people living in disadvantage and a lot more money tackling climate change and the economy grew, I'd be over the moon. So we kind of can't have these democratic debates about what we want to do personally or collectively because of the language. So, yeah, to some extent, this is a bit of a sequel to a conibabble. It sort of says, look, we've just got to strip all this kind of dodgy economics out of it and get back to democratic conversations about what kind of country we want to have.
Does the economy, though, have to grow overall for it to kind of function? Won't it collapse in on itself if it's not growing?
No. It's possible to have economic growth. So when we talk about economic growth, we're usually talking about GDP, gross domestic product, sort of market price of all the stuff that got bought and sold. So people will be shocked to see me squeeze an Adani reference in here. But when a foreign-owned mine opens up in Australia, which by its owner's description will be automated from pit to port, then the total value of the coal that gets sold, every $1 billion of coal exports count in Australia's GDP. Every billion of coal exports. But imagine an Indian company, and Dave Richardson here, I've got to thank him for this fantastic example. Imagine an Indian company sold $1 billion worth of coal to China. Where do you think the check gets posted? But where do you think... actually, the Caribbean. Someone's been reading our op-eds. Right? But the way we measure GDP, the way we measure gross domestic product, every $1 billion worth of coal exported by Adani, the Cayman Islands listed company, counts in Australia's GDP. So there's no doubt that that project will increase Australia's GDP. Will it employ many people? No. Will it pay much tax? No. Will the checks even get posted to Australia? Probably not. But when we calculate GDP, does it count in our GDP? Yeah, it does. So there are things that we can do that grow the economy that create no jobs. And there are things that we can do that grow the economy that create lots of jobs. Aged care. Every $1 million you spend on aged care creates around 13 jobs. Every $1 million you spend on mining creates about 2. So big picture, what I argue in the book is it's the shape of the economy that we need to worry about. What stuff are we making? Not the size. So, no, the economy doesn't have to grow for us to have happy lives. Indeed, if we spend a lot less money on crap that no one used for Christmas and donated it all to the Australia Institute instead, we would change the shape of the economy. That would be bad for the retail sector. Okay, let's be clear. If everyone stopped spending lots of money buying stuff no one used, that would shrink this part of the economy that sells stuff no one uses. It's not complicated. Right? When we stopped whaling, the whaling sector shrank. When we stopped asbestos mining, the asbestos sector shrank. It didn't destroy the economy, but it changed its shape. So, no, I think if we stopped buying stuff that no one used, if we stopped digging up coal and causing climate change, we wouldn't ruin the economy, but we would ruin parts of the economy. In the same way that digital cameras ruined the photo development labs, and in the same way your smartphone ruined the street directory industry. No, but this is the point. It's changing all the time. People are losing their jobs all the time. The fact that change leads to unemployment doesn't make change bad. It means we need to be nice to the unemployed.
I wanted to pick up... I'll take some questions from the crowd in a second. I wanted to pick up on that point, a section in the book that talks about how much our culture focuses on a factory closing or a mine not going ahead and the amount of jobs that are lost in that. And they might be 100, they might be 500, they might be 300. But such a bigger proportion of people lose their jobs all the time and find new ones. What's the point of reflecting upon that? And what does the effect of our society so focusing on those loss of jobs have on our politics and our economics?
Let me be entirely apolitical in answering this. When Tony Abbott sacked 14,000 public servants, That was devastating. That was devastating. But he got elected promising to sack those people. Promising to sack them. Vote for me and I will fund tax cuts by sacking more than 10,000 public servants.
But public servants they're not real jobs.
Apparently. Exactly. This is how broken our debate is. So Campbell Newman was elected promising to sack promising not to, and then sack 10,000 people. So when people lose their jobs, when Kodak went broke, that was devastating for people who work at Kodak. And I blame each and every one of you with a smartphone. When politicians sack public servants, that's devastating for not just them, but their families and their communities. When we privatise things, which we've spent 20 years doing, we do so knowing that people will be sacked. So, and similarly, when technology comes along, when was the last time anyone here picked up a phone, rang a hotel and said, do you have any rooms available next week? Seriously, you did, Hannah. What? Can I introduce you to the smartphone? Right. So every time you book a hotel online, understand that you led to some receptionist somewhere losing their job. And tens of thousands of receptionists have lost their jobs. Just like the photo development labs, just like the people that used to sell street directories. So I'm not making these numbers up. Banking, absolutely. All right, every time you use an ATM, you're a job-destroying teller sacker. All right, and same when you're at Coles and Woolworths. But here's my point. Every month in Australia, every month, more than 300,000 people lose their job. Every month. And every month in Australia, more than 300,000 people get a new job. So there's this incredible turmoil in our labour market with people losing jobs and getting new jobs all the time. And when we hear that 500 or 1,000 people lose their job at a factory, don't get me wrong, that's devastating for them and for that community. But in the scheme of an Australian economy where 300,000 people are losing their non-newsworthy jobs, they're non-newsworthy unemployed, they're non-very symbolically unemployed, they're just lonely and poor, but they didn't work at something where a gate got shut and someone could film that gate getting closed. When all those people lose their jobs, we kind of don't care. So we've created this sort of political debate now where conservative politicians will sack tens of thousands of people in a heartbeat and say we can't tackle climate change because someone might lose their job. Think about that, how ridiculous that is. So we have to understand the chaos and the brutal reality of what the labour market really looks like for everyone who becomes unemployed so that we can A, be more generous to everyone who becomes unemployed, and B, to not fall for feeling guilty that because I want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, I'm personally responsible for the unemployment of a coal miner somewhere. To be clear, I'm worried about coal miners losing their jobs to robots. I'm worried about coal miners losing their jobs to the pit-to-port project that Adani wants to build. It's not just tackling climate change that will lead to coal miners losing their jobs. It's technology. We can cause climate change and employ almost no one to do it. So I guess what I'm trying to do in the book is to say, let's get our head around the horrible reality of unemployment. Let's be far more sympathetic to the 730,000 unemployed people out there today. But let's not kid ourselves that we should cause climate change to stop some people losing their jobs. Because people are going to lose their jobs next week, regardless of whether we cause climate change or not. Mm.
Paul Oberhof, political economist at uni. I just wanted to know, in regards to the applicability of what you're speaking about, I could imagine that a concern about affluenza might be of interest to, say, the people who benefit from the real estate market, such as it is. But in terms of the latest ABS census stats, it shows that I think about a quarter of the male workforce now is in non-full-time work, and for women it's even more, and it's been increasing since the 70s, and I'm just wondering whether for that portion of the workforce who may not be able to have the sort of money to afford stuff, for them such concerns might be, pardon the pun, academic. And supplementary question, are you making an argument for the services sector?
No, thanks. It's a good question. And it's interesting. I mean, kind of that question probably goes to the biggest difference between the book I wrote with Clive Hamilton 12 years ago and this one. This book's really not about... Well, I'll go back a step. I think 12 years ago, when we wrote Affluenza, it was a bit of a punch in the face for Australian society. It said, you're kidding yourselves about being the land of the long weekend and the sickie and the smoker. That died. We killed that. You all work really hard. You work the longest hours in the world. You got huge amounts of debt. You're all stressed. And you waste enormous amounts of money on crap you don't use. That's what. And when we said that, everyone went, oh, that can't be true. It was like, yeah, kind of is. And the first interview I did on this book, Fran Kelly said, so, you know, are things better or worse now? And I hadn't thought of that. And I thought, oh, shit. Worse. Because now we've embraced it. Like, you'd say 12 years ago we hadn't noticed. But now we all know. We know we do it. And we've invented these arguments. Sure, I'm chucking all this crap out, but it's good for the economy. We've invented these kind of social justifications for it. So this book's not about saying, don't buy a big television, it won't make you happy. It doesn't say that at all. It says, love your telly. I mean it. Love it. Hang on to it. If it makes you happy, great. Whatever gets you off is fine by me, but don't chuck it out. Don't chuck it out to get a new one. If you love it, love it. So, you know, really what I'm... This book doesn't say, here's a whole bunch of middle-class anxiety, go sit on a mountaintop and meditate and abandon your stuff. It says that affluenza is a cultural phenomenon. Affluenza is not a personal affliction. It's a contagious disease that we caught off each other. And we've created new norms for the first time in 7,000 years of recorded history. We've created new norms. Like, it's okay to chuck out perfectly useful stuff. It's okay to spend $10 a litre on bottled water and then throw the bottle out. No, seriously, this is a new idea. It's brand new. And we can keep doing it if we want. But it's not making us rich. It's not making us happy. It's costing us a fortune. And if the other 6 billion people on the planet try and live like this, it can't work. So I haven't tried to set out in the book to cure all middle-class anxiety about what it's okay to spend your money on. The book says that we as a community have to confront the fact that we've created a culture where we waste enormous amounts of time and money and natural resources for purely symbolic purposes. Now, men used to wear cod pieces for purely symbolic purposes, and we kind of laugh at that now. Do you think in a couple of hundred years' time people will look back at some of our purely symbolic displays and think, what a strange thing to do? So that's what I'm really writing about in the book. I'm not trying to tell people that are struggling to pay the rent to feel guilty about the things they buy that cheer them up, telling them the opposite. If it cheers you up, buy it. But don't chuck it out if it cheered you up.
Hi. I totally agree with your ideas. It's just sometimes it's hard to put it into practice. So, for example, whenever I need new eyeglasses and I say to the optometrist, you know, I've got about 10 pairs of frames at home, can I just get the lenses changed? And they say, no, you can't. You have to buy new ones, new frames. That's one, you know, that's just an example of a challenge. I've got about 5 laptops because my 3 old ones that are sort of half alive but don't do everything I need, I can't let go of them because I feel so guilty. You know, I think society's now structured in a way that it's actually hard to hold on to things because they're made for us to throw them away. How do we address that problem?
Yeah, look, great question. And there's, to be clear, there's no simple answer, and my big picture answer is guilt won't save the planet. So don't beat yourself up too much. 23 years ago, I went out for the first ever breakfast that I bought. It's 1994. I paid someone $20 for breakfast. I'd never done that before, and turned out I'm not alone in thinking that's a good idea. And as a result, we have created something we now call cafe culture. Culture. We've created a culture. No, I mean it. We've created a culture where if you feel like going out for breakfast on a Saturday or a Sunday, you'll find plenty of choice. I was in Norway recently, one of the richest countries in the world, and try getting some eggs on toast on a Sunday in Norway. They don't have cafe culture, which made my personal desire to pay someone to make me eggs very hard to act on. No, this is important because the shop only exists when there's more than one person that wants to do it. And there's a chicken and egg, pardon the pun, argument here. Like, did we all want it first or did the shop come first? And this is kind of how capitalism, what it actually does pretty well. So if we all want to get stuff repaired, it's actually hard to get stuff repaired at the moment because we don't get stuff repaired. And I don't get stuff repaired because you don't, and you don't get stuff repaired because I don't. So how do we tell the repair shop to please set up? Because if they did, we'd both come. Well, 20 years ago, no one went out for breakfast in Australia, and now cafes employ more people than the mining industry ever did in the peak of the mining boom. So if we collectively send the signal that we're up for this, I actually have faith in the market, because the market doesn't exist. The market is just some greedy people trying to get rich, making us happy. That's why they serve me breakfast. So what I say in the book is there's a whole bunch of stuff that you can do as an individual, and if you want to, you should. But there's a whole bunch of stuff that can only happen if we all kind of start going that way. And some of it needs government to step in and say, well, if you make washing machines, they have to last for 10 years. No, they have to. It's a statutory warranty. Right? We can make laws. We make car companies put seatbelts in. We can make washing machine companies offer 10-year warranties. And then they'll start making things that last for 10 years. But you can't make them do that, and I can't make them do that. But we can make them do anything we want. So the book says there's stuff you can do. There's stuff we can do by forming groups that care, and there's stuff that government has to come in. But the worst thing we can tell ourselves is that someone else is in charge of culture, that the market tells us what we can and can't have. That's bullshit. It's the market, the global market didn't give us smashed avocado, right? We did. What an achievement. Created a lot of jobs, though.
Richard, is that what you mean when you say here at the end of the preface that we don't need to reframe the debate or reform our policies, which to most people are the two political levers, change the communication or change the policies, we need to fundamentally reshape the economy?
Yeah, absolutely. Every time you spend money on stuff, you just voted for it. And the people that sold it to you will sell more of it when you keep voting for it with your dollar votes. And when we all stop buying street directories, those companies go away. Now, I'm not, and by the way, millionaires have a lot more dollar votes than unemployed people. There's nothing fair about this. But when millions of people decide that they don't want to buy bottled water because they can remember they get thirsty, like, I know it's a bit tricky. It's hard to imagine, all right? But when millions of people say, you know what? Why am I spending more money on bottled water than I am on petrol? That's odd. I'm going to not do that. Then the industry will go away. All right, and we don't need permission. But if we want to spend more money on aged care or Indigenous disadvantage, I reckon we're going to need to work collectively on that. We're going to have to vote for people that say, vote for me and I'll spend more on that. So there's no silver bullet here. But yeah, we actually just have to believe that every time we spend money on stuff, that's an important decision. Every time we vote for someone, that's an important decision. Every time we join a community organisation, volunteer our labour, support a charity, you know, you've just, every time you do that, you reshape the economy. I did an event in Melbourne last week and it was with the Victorian Women's Trust. It's about this many people. It was $20 a head to get in. They raised $3,000 that went to help domestic violence abuse victims in Victoria. That's $3,000 that didn't get spent on stuff. It didn't shrink the economy. It changed its shape. Every time you spend your money, you influence the shape of the economy. Every time you cast a vote, you influence the shape of the economy. Every time you volunteer your time or donate money to a group, you change the shape of the economy. We don't need permission to do that.
Do you see human scale development and things like LETS as above or below the curve of what you're talking about?
Oh, I don't think there's anything above or below what I'm talking about. What I'm trying to say, this sounds kind of, it's probably banal, but I think it's important. All of the decisions we make matter. Like, I think we've got out, and this is, comes back to Ben's question, we kind of get these false binaries. Do I want to tackle climate change by going to international climate talks, or do I want to do it by buying less crap that I bury? Well, both, please. Why choose? So the purpose of the book really is to say that at an individual level, there's stuff we can do. At a community level, here in Canberra, we're investing enormously in public transport. We've got a 100% renewable energy target. These are not just things that affect us here in Canberra. They're evidence to the rest of the world that a city-state can have a 100% renewable energy target, and that's not crazy. So doing it here in Canberra actually makes it easier for other people to do it somewhere else. So, I think this idea of, do I need to aim big or do I need to act small? I think that's killing us. I think we just got to pull on any levers we can find. And big picture, what I'm arguing, I suppose, in the book is that our personal choices, like, remembering to get that I'll get thirsty today and visibly walking around with my own water bottle and carrying my own bag to the shops, those symbolic statements help other people remember that they get thirsty too and might be able to solve that problem. And when lots of people do that, it gets easier to legislate a ban on plastic bags. I guess to some extent, yeah, now Marilyn Waring's a personal hero of mine. She changed the way I saw economics and the world I live in. But Marilyn, her piece in the book is entirely in accord with what I'm about to say. It's not about the indicators. Like, sure, go measure the things that matter. I've played that game for 20 years. But whether we measure the impact of me being nice or not is irrelevant. I think I should be nice. So, yeah, we need new indicators, but we just have to stop obsessing about dumb indicators as well as put effort into creating new ones. They're not mutually exclusive, but, I just think we need to act as a community and as individuals in ways that accord with the kind of country we want to live in.
Doesn't it happen that sometimes the market or people who make things can actually choose the way we buy things? Because I can remember when my kids were little, I used to knit. I love knitting. So I knitted them jumpers and cardigans, my two eldest, and I made their clothes. By the time my third daughter was born, it was more expensive for me to buy the wool than it was to go out and buy a ready-made jumper. So I stopped knitting. Similarly, it was more expensive to buy the material than it was to go to Target and buy the ready-made clothes, so I stopped sewing. So isn't that a way that the market actually controls what we do?
I would say it influences what we do, absolutely. And this sort of comes back to the point I was trying to make before. If I'm the only person, if I'm the only person in Canberra that wants to get my laptop repaired, no one's going to set up a laptop repair shop. But if a lot of people do, then they will. So don't get me wrong. Well, go back a step. What is the market? The market is us acting collectively. All right? There's no thing called the market. There's no place called the market. There's no person called the market that decides these things. Does Apple, in inventing the smartphone, did they wait for us to say we want smartphones? No, they actually bet billions of dollars that if they made it, we would come. And they were right. They did. And I'm glad. I'm very happy with the convenience that comes with my smartphone. But they didn't make me buy it. And a lot of people have spent billions of dollars inventing things that didn't get sold. Right? There's a lot of people that had the genius idea that never worked. So there's no doubt at the moment that it's cheaper to get your washing machine, to buy a new one than to get it repaired. That might be true. But is your house full of the cheapest stuff you can find? We talk all the time about, you know, the cost of stuff. And it might be. And I'm not judging you either way. I'm just saying that not many people go out food shopping and just kind of buy the cheapest food they can buy. Some people do. Not many people go out and buy the cheapest everything they can buy. Some people do. But we've kind of got this weird thing. On the one hand, we're critical of the logic of the market, yet then we say, well, you'd be crazy to not go and buy a shirt when it's, you know, when it's dearer to make your own. Well, yeah, no, there's policy there, but no one makes us buy cheap crap that we don't really like. No one makes us. They make it convenient. They make it cheap. Perhaps, right? But again, there's no silver bullet in the book. But when we sit back, there's no silver bullet, but there's one big bad guy in the book. The bad guy is that the market did it. Okay? That the market did it. That the global economy did it. And we're all powerless because they did it to us. And you're right. This is not easy. But the world we live in today looks nothing like the world I grew up in 40 years ago. And the world in 40 years' time will look nothing like it does today. Who's going to shape the direction of change? Because every time you say them or the market, you're giving up. There's no such thing. There are people out there that want to change your values and behaviour in particular ways to make more money for themselves. This is not a level playing field. But the market won't decide what we think is normal in 10 years' time. We will. They'll change the choices we're offered. They'll change the relative prices. But I often buy stuff that costs more because I want to for a whole range of reasons. And I often will buy things that cost a lot less, like water. I like it from a tap.
The question was, why are conservatives convinced that trickle-down economics will work?
great question. And to be clear, a lot of this book is written for conservatives. The preface is about my parents, who are very conservative politically. Nice people, I think. I love them quite a lot. I think they're a bit screwed up in the way they vote, but that's okay. I like a lot of conservatives. And conservatives, especially older conservatives, hate the idea that we're getting rich by importing stuff and burying it in the ground. It does their head in to say that's waste. So a lot of conservatives hate waste. And this book is about saying, well, how is wasting things helping us get rich? The trickle-down stuff, that's an interesting question. I don't think you're cynical enough. They don't think it's going to work. No, I mean that. Right? I don't know about you, but other people have fallen into a trap of taking them seriously. Right? Because what they're saying is, I'd like to cut taxes for rich people because I like rich people. Okay, that's why they're cutting tax cuts. That's why they're cutting taxes for rich people, because they want to. And then rather than say I'm doing that because I want to, they go blah, 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 incentive, blah, 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 effect, blah, blah, unemployed, blah, 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 create jobs. They don't believe a word of it. There's no empirical evidence to support that it works. There's no historical evidence. There's plenty of international experience of rich countries with high taxes. There's plenty of international experience of poor countries with low taxes. So I understand the premise of your question, but don't take them seriously. They're cutting taxes for rich people because they want to change our society. They're cutting taxes for rich people because they want to reshape our society. They're cutting taxes for rich people because they want to create a new culture where that's an acceptable thing to do. And it worked. They did it. And we don't want to use economics to argue back sometimes.
I just wanted to ask you, you talk about you should love what you buy. How can you do that? Because it seems to me that if I want something, I buy it and I love it, but feelings change and they're temporary and perspective changes. So how can I love something indefinitely until it breaks?
Yeah. Thanks for the Dorothy Dixer. So imagine you just bought a little puppy. Beautiful little puppy. Cute little puppy. It's so cute. And then it got a bit bigger. A bit bigger. And then a new litter of puppies came along. So you killed the first one. And got the cute little puppy. You can do that if you want. You can kill puppies every 6 months and always have the cutest little puppy that anyone had seen. And that's... No, I'm not kidding. You can, and people do, right? Not you, the person sitting next to you I'm a bit worried about. And the puppy might be a phone, or the puppy might be some shoes, or I don't know what it is, but I know some people do this. But let's be clear. If you killed the puppy, you never loved the puppy. No, you didn't. You loved the thrill of having a new cute puppy. That's consumerism. You can consume puppies in the same way that you can consume stuff, because they're material objects. So you're right. If you love the thrill of the new, that's fine. It's okay. That's a perfectly human emotion. But understand that you're not. You didn't love the thing and get tired of it. You never loved the thing. You love the thrill of the new thing. That's the difference at the beginning between consumerism and materialism. So, yeah, maybe you just love having new stuff all the time, and that's fine. I've chucked out stuff and replaced it with new stuff. I'm not going to beat myself up over that. But the point of the book is quite simple. If the other 6 billion people on this planet adopt the same cultural norm, that's kind of a fun thing to do, we're stuffed. We can't all live like that. You can, I can, it's everyone else I'm worried about. So, yeah, the idea that we just chuck out stuff and get new stuff because the new stuff is fun, fine, I get it. The purpose of the book is to say, this is a new idea, this is a new culture we've created. Once upon a time, if your jacket got a bit old, you took it somewhere and they embroidered a new pattern on it, and now you had a new embroidered jacket. Now we chuck the whole jacket out because it's last year's colour. That's a new idea. And that's a new culture. And we can live like that. No one's going to stop us. But if we do, it has consequences. And if you don't want to kill all the puppies, you'll be on my side.
It's been a really great talk, Richard. I haven't got a question, but I have a suggestion to make, that we all go home and give 10 people a Christmas present, your book, and we ring 10 people and say, can you also do it? So the domino effect.
Thank you very much. I won't take that as a question. I'll take that as an excellent advertisement. Which does remind me of one question. I'm going to sneak one in, which I've been told was the best question that somebody heard asked elsewhere. What does somebody who wrote Curing Affluenza want for Christmas?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Ben heard me answer this, and I struggle with this because nothing is the honest answer. I don't want anything. But I figured out years ago that it was selfish to want nothing. No, I did. It made people who cared about me feel bad. In hindsight, I was just a selfish prick. No, seriously. Stop boring me, Mum. I don't care. I don't care about my birthday. What's that got to do with you? Exactly. Takes a while, doesn't it? My mum thinks my birthday's an important day for her. And I spent a lot of years telling her to stop boring me with questions about what I wanted for my birthday. I do, I feel bad about it. So it's actually selfish sometimes to say, I don't care, I don't want anything. So now I try and think up answers to the questions, and they're rarely new stuff, basically. I don't need any stuff, I'm fine. But that doesn't mean people can't help me. It doesn't mean there aren't thoughtful things they can do for me. And sometimes people want a hint. So, yeah, I've softened quite a lot on that. I give people hints. But like, I forgot about this. I got interviewed about this recently. And I remember that in 1997, in my peak get stuff, don't buy me stuff phase, I was having a housewarming and I told everyone, don't buy me any stuff, and I could feel stuff coming. So I told everyone, I said, just give me a recipe. Just give me a recipe. And it was great. I got all these great recipes. And one of my friends gave me a big framed effing recipe. And you know what? I hung it up on the wall and I love it. So, I still cook some of those recipes. I really do. So, not wanting stuff doesn't have to turn you into the Grinch.
First of all, I just find really everything you say about kind of the market to be quite incredibly silly and naive, to be honest with you.
I've never really understood them.
Well, that's evident. But like, I would like to get a house one day, for instance. It's not going to happen. Like, you look at the rising housing prices, rising youth unemployment in this country, rising homelessness, 100,000 people homeless now. And they're going to stay homeless probably for the rest of their lives, most of them. And that's not because there's an inadequate number of houses or some other market mechanism is not being fulfilled. There's more than enough houses. There's a huge surplus of them. But those people don't get houses because they can't afford them, and they can't make... If you're living on the street, you're not going to be able to make some sort of lifestyle choice that's going to get you moving into a mansion in Toorak tomorrow. That's completely unavailable to them. Or look at the situation on Manus Island at the moment. What lifestyle choices are those refugees making to put them in Manus Island? What lifestyle choices should they make differently? None. There's no market that's available to them that they can influence, that they can create, as you constantly say. It's a ludicrous thing to say that. That's self-evidently not the case. And that's how the economy works more broadly in our society. Issues like hunger, environmental destruction, what you will, these aren't just abstract interpersonal relations that are going the wrong way. This is how the market functions. It's a dictatorship of a minority. And what happens on the quote-unquote market is what's good for them, not what's good for the rest of us, regardless of what we do. And that extends actually into politics as well. But your point about voting is really fascinating.
By the way, I agree with nearly everything you've said so far. So,
well, that's good. I'm glad I'm winning you over. But again, about politics just briefly. Like, the Iraq War never had majority support in Australia. Never had majority of support, yet it still happened. 1 million people died in Iraq. The Labor Party, in the last Queensland election, the next one's coming up on Saturday, campaigned that they would save the Great Barrier Reef. And we've seen what they've wanted to do with Adani, seen what they're doing with mines in Western Australia, and generally state and federal governments subsidising the mining industry to the tune of more than $10 billion annually in Australia. So I think the function, the ideas that are put forward by people like yourself when you talk about the importance of consumer choice and conscientious relationships with the market on the part of individuals, actually, it's not just facile and wrong. It plays a profoundly negative role in our society because it glosses over that reality, which is that the functioning of the economy and of the political system actually just exists to fulfill the needs and desires of a tiny minority at the expense of us. And it serves to pacify and distract the people who should actually be organising themselves in order to challenge that sort of agenda. And where we have seen the sort of advances that you seem to imply necessary take place historically. So the point is, don't you think it would be more useful if we had, say, a rebirth of the trade union movement, protest movements, civil disobedience and resistance on the part of the people who are screwed over by the economy, rather than flashing pretty lights in their faces and telling them to just buy more avocado?
You know, I think what would be useful is if you read my book. because, you know, I think politics is very important, and I think public debate is very important, and I don't know that name-calling is an important part of public debate. So I don't mind the names that you've called me, but I do mind that you seem to be unaware that everything I've worked on in my life is about trying to overcome the structural things you've talked about. I think I've done more than most in the public realm to talk about the structural problems in our housing market. I think I've done more than most in the public debate, because our public debate is full of the kind of voices that you seem to be worried about. I've done more than most in those debates to talk about the fact that it's our tax system and our planning system that makes housing unaffordable for the people that you describe. And there's absolutely nothing in the book that suggests that your consumption choices will fix the housing market. Indeed, that was my answer to the earlier question, that there are some things we can only fix collectively. And that's why I talk about the role of unions in the book. That's why there are specific contributions from other people, including unionists, in the book, to remind people how as communities we've confronted exactly these sorts of issues. So, for example, the weekend didn't come about because the market chose the weekend. The weekend came about because the trade union movement demanded it. In 1901, there was zero annual leave in Australia. We got 1 week, then 2 weeks, then 3 weeks, then 4 weeks by the 1970s. The market didn't deliver that. Organised union campaigns delivered that. Now, in Australia, we stopped at 4 weeks because three would be too few and five would be too many. But in a whole bunch of other countries, they went five, six, seven, because the trade union movement in other countries has pushed for that. So I agree it would be facile to suggest that individual consumption choices would do anything to overcome structural inequality. It would be not just facile, it would be empirically wrong. And I'm glad that I'm not facile or empirically wrong, because I didn't make any such claim. The purpose of the book is to say that we have agency as individuals in some domains, we have agencies as organisations in some domains, and we have to organise politically. We have to organise politically if we are to drive big changes. So I agree with nearly everything you said, but I really do hope you read the book.
So I've got a question about how some of the issues you've been talking about might interact with what you might call conventional economics. So I guess my sort of understanding of the conventional economics of work and leisure and consumption is that they're at some sort of equilibrium, then the government comes along, introduces some taxes, and that kind of gets people to shift away from work and consumption and do more leisure. And then this imposes like a cost on the economy. And then if you do something like introduce an environmental tax on top of that, and you try to model what that would mean with, say, a CGE model, you get all these costs from the interaction with these taxes, which are getting people to shift further towards leisure. But I think the issues you've been talking about today might say that the conventional economics, if that view that I just sort of described, might be wrong. And I'm wondering what you thought of that and what implications there might be of this.
Yeah, no, good question. I mean, there's a real kind of problem with the way we talk about conventional economics, for the simple reason that conventional economics says one thing and then is used to do another. So when we teach, you know, I've taught economics for 20 years, and every textbook in the world that's used in universities starts with the assertion that economics is value-free. Well, I'm glad you're laughing, because every economics textbook in the world makes that assertion up front. It says, we don't do values. If you want to buy pizza or hamburgers, why would I care? If you want to spend your money on an umbrella and I want to spend my money on a raincoat, who am I to tell you the best way to spend your money? And that's why most economics, you know, pretty libertarian. And sign me up. I don't want you telling me what I want for dinner. But having moved from the assertion that economics is value-free and we should trust individuals to make their own choices, When people say, well, I prefer leisure to stuff, we go, well, that's not right. No, you can't choose that. No, that's bad for the economy. So it's bizarre. We've invented this conventional economics that's very libertarian, but then we come and impose a bizarre form of socialism that says, no, you have to go and buy stuff that you don't want because that's good for the economy. Take one for the team. Waste your money on crap to create jobs for poor people. Trickle-down economics. Whereas the premise of economics is we'd never really do that. So I understand what you're saying, but really the critique of economics needs to be bigger than the one that you mounted, and that is twofold. One, it's just crap to suggest you can separate values from policy decisions or values from goals. That's crap. We need to have a public debate about what those goals and values are. But secondly, and this is probably my favourite example in the book, the largest irrigated crop in the US is lawn. Lawn. It's a crop. We harvest it with lawnmowers. All right? And what do we do with the harvested crop? We throw it away. But here's the thing. That's a cultural idea. The idea that a lawn is a neat way to be a good neighbour is a 70-year-old, mainly Anglophone phenomena. And with the culture of lawn comes this incredible amount of economic activity called Jim's mowing and lawn seed and lawn mowers, you name it. But my point is it's culture that drives all that economic activity. Yet in the economics textbook, we'd say, why do people grow lawn? I don't know, demand curve for lawn, price of lawn seed. If lawn's cheap, people choose lawn. No, seriously, that's the logic of it. We've actually expunged culture from our understanding of culture because we pretend that the market made us have a lawn. All right? Or anyone here who wears a suit, any men who wear a suit, have a look at your sleeve next time, please. You'll find 3 or 4 buttons there. What the F are they doing on your jacket? All right. No, I'm not kidding. Like, we do things like wear ties and have 4 buttons on our suit jackets because that's what we do. And that, by the way, is why we waste enormous amounts of energy. 4 buttons at a tie. And so do I. I'm not judging. I'm just saying so much of our activity is culturally determined, yet we've told ourselves it's all about price. It's rubbish. It's culturally determined, and we can change that just like we got rid of the codpiece.